From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on President Trump's third day in office last Wednesday. The president signed an executive order meant to dismantle DEI, which stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Supporters of DEI initiatives point out that the practice was designed to address long-standing systemic inequities, to promote fair opportunities and build inclusive work environments. As described by Felix Richter at the data firm Statista, DEI initiatives focus on removing barriers, amplifying underrepresented voices, and ensuring equitable access to career opportunities and resources. But that is not how conservatives tend to view DEI. Activists like Chris Rufo argue that DEI efforts run counter to the principle of merit by disadvantaging people who do not meet DEI criteria. Specifically, Rufo argues that DEI is designed to force white men out of the hiring pool and to make white people feel shame. Here's how President Trump himself described it last week.
My administration has taken action to abolish all discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion nonsense. And these are policies that were absolute nonsense throughout the government and the private sector. With the recent yet somewhat unexpected great Supreme Court decision just made, America will once again become a merit-based country.
In his executive order, which describes DEI efforts as radical, wasteful, illegal, and immoral discrimination programs, Trump ordered the immediate termination of all DEI programs and activities under whatever name they appear. The president also ordered that all federal employees in DEI programs were be placed on paid administrative leave immediately. Next up, his administration wants to find ways to dismantle DEI in corporate America and in academia. Big retailers are already responding. CBS News reports the following, quote, Target said Friday that it would join Walmart and a number of other prominent American brands in scaling back diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives that have come under attack from conservative activists and, as of this week, the White House. The Minneapolis-based retailer Target said the changes to its Belonging at the Bullseye strategy would include ending a program it established to help black employees build meaningful careers, improve the experience of black shoppers, and to promote black-owned businesses, end quote. Now, Pew Research finds that support for DEI in the workplace is falling. Several years ago, it was around 60% with very little opposition. Now support stands around 50%. Support for DEI has eroded the most among American men. What's not clear is exactly how far the Trump administration can go to cut funding to organizations or schools that maintain DEI programs. Defenders of DEI say that it is meant to provide opportunity where opportunity was historically denied. But not all opponents of DEI are members of Trump's team. Dr. Tabia Lee was hired to direct the DEI program for a California community college. She was fired for, she writes, criticizing how DEI operates. She later said, quote, at its worst, DEI is built on the unshakable belief that the world is divided into two groups of people only, the oppressors and the oppressed, end quote. She wanted her students to understand complexity. She says that idea was not welcome. We're going to talk about a lot of different ways that DEI is perhaps working, or maybe it could be reformed. I don't know. Our guests are going to bring you their perspectives, and we're going to talk about how they see the practice of DEI at a time when it is clearly under assault. Let me welcome our guests now. Welcome in studio to Jessica Lewis, President and CEO of LALU Public Relations. Jessica, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Chad Anderson, who is the Vice President of BloomRock. Chad, welcome back. Tell people what Bloom is.
BloomRock is a nonpartisan nonprofit formed here in Rochester, New York. We're focused on creating and sustaining creating and protecting sustainable economic development within socioeconomic equity demographics, which is essentially DEI demographics.
All right. Well, thank you for being here. We appreciate that. Welcome in studio to Bill Maley, who's the supervisor of the town of Brighton, which we talked about DEI with Bill a couple of, maybe three, 4 years ago. I don't remember. Something
probably
like that.
3 years ago.
Three years ago. Yeah. So the town of Brighton has is a chief diversity officer, yes?
That's right. And in fact, she was on the show with me last time, Miriam Moore, our chief diversity officer. I'm sure I'll have a chance to take issue with some of those quotes, but for us, DEI in a community like Brighton that is diverse and its diversity is what makes it so attractive to so many people, You know, local government is the government closest to the people. If we are not attuned to that diversity, if we're not open and receptive to working with everybody in a town like Brighton, I'm not doing my job. We're not doing our job.
All right, let me also welcome on the phone Sim Covington Jr. Dr. Covington Jr. is the Chief Diversity Officer for Finger Lakes Community College, FLCC. Sim, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Evan.
So everybody in this program has a slightly different sector of our community that they represent. And I think it'll be useful just to kind of get some opening comments, and I'll go around the panel and I'll start with Jessica. When you think about DEI, how has your own work intersected with that first?
Sure. Well, for me as a business owner, I would say that it's something that's very important. I'm a Black-owned business, woman-owned business, and I have that certification through the state of New York. And so seeing me as such is important because of the work that we do. We value DEI as an agency and with the organizations and businesses that we partner with and whom we provide service to. And so I think that this rollback will have implications that we may not all be aware of in terms of the breadth and depth of anything fallout that could potentially occur. I know that there's so much conversation right now happening in the land of social media because people are upset about it. Some of their favorite retailers are rolling back and they're wondering why.
We'll talk more about that coming up here. Chad, how do you see DEI in your work at BloomRock?
Absolutely. So like I said, BloomRock is a nonpartisan nonprofit here in Rochester, New York. For those of you who don't know, we are essentially operating in the cannabis space. The MRTA, the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, passed in March of 2021, was passed with a suggestion that 51% of the cannabis market in New York State adult use market always be socioeconomic equity. There's five classifications of what that actually is. All DEI, we have our minority-owned businesses, our women-owned businesses, our service-disabled veterans, our distressed farmers, and our individuals from communities disproportionately impacted. So, you know, in the intro when I said DEI is essentially the root being of who BloomRock is, who we are, how we position ourselves in the industry, is exactly what I mean by that. You know, we advocate for the voiceless, essentially making sure they have all the tools and resources they need to be successful in this very competitive cannabis market.
Supervisor Maley, in the town of Brighton, in the several years that you've had a chief diversity officer, has it made town operations better?
I think it has, but it's more than just town operations. We've looked at it, and it was very much thought out. We first developed what we call our IDEA plan, our Inclusion, Diversity, and Equity Action Plan, working with a very diverse group of town residents. To similar in some ways to what we do with land use. We wanted to, you know, think very thoughtfully about how we were going to approach this problem. We were doing it during the pandemic, so we had to be a little more creative about engaging with the community. We found other communities that were doing similar work, in particular Beaverton, Oregon. We had a great opportunity to meet and talk with them. But it's everything from the kinds of events that we, for example, just celebrated. We just celebrated Dr. Martin Luther King Day with a great event honoring Ruth Scott, a trailblazer in the city of Rochester and now living in the town of Brighton where she's been an active volunteer. So we're active in the community, whether it's Indigenous Peoples-related events, Pride, but we're also focused internally. We want to make sure that internally we understand what we need to do. You know, one of the areas we're really focused on jobs, workforce development, and our thinking on that is very simple. Bigger net, more fish. We're not looking to discriminate. What we're looking to do is reach out to more people so that more people in different communities know about job opportunities and volunteer opportunities with the town of Brighton. That gives us a better opportunity to find the best people and do our jobs.
Before I turn to Dr. Covington Jr., let me just press that point when you say bigger net, more fish. Mm-hmm. This has been a point of contention that some of the advisors to President Trump have pointed out. Their claim, people like Chris Rufo, who again, RUFO, if you don't know Chris Rufo, he's one of the most powerful people in the country right now. He is setting a sort of cultural agenda that has been rolling out for the last 3 years or so, and he's got the president's ear. So he's declaring victory over DEI. And he says part of the reason, Bill, is apart from, or maybe contrary to bigger net, more fish, he points to examples, kind of ad hoc examples, where he'll point to a university that said, you know, internal documents would show, hey, this next hire has to be a person of color. This next, we cannot hire another white person for this department. You know, we need more people of color. And Rufo will point to that and say, 1964, you know, law says you can't do that, and that's all DEI is now. And he finds these ad hoc examples. What do you make of some of that, contrasting it to what you're talking about with what Brighton is trying to do?
Well, you can always talk about anecdotes, but that is not how we view DEI. We truly do see it as an opportunity. If we have more, it's tough finding, for example, job applicants these days. Unemployment is quite low. The economy has been very strong. So we want to make
that's
sure.
That's not what I've heard. Excuse me.
And I don't know about the price of eggs today. But what I do know is that it is hard, and we want to make sure we're engaging with groups in the community, you know, settlement houses, Ibero, other organizations that are working to make sure that they can place people in jobs. We have entry. We just last night, I'll let folks know we've got a new job opening in our parks department for a ground equipment operator, someone who will be helping get parks ready, running lawnmowers, running all sorts of equipment to serve our park department. We have a long history of hiring people and retaining people and promoting people through our organization. Our new deputy commissioner of public works started 23 years ago as a laborer in our public works department. And we want to make sure we're drawing from the entire community to do that. It is not about pushing anybody else out of the job. And as I mentioned, it's volunteers as well. You know, we couldn't do what we do without the volunteers who serve on boards like our planning board. We have a budget review task force. One of our idea board volunteers had a long finance record and business record with one of Rochester's largest employers. I looked at her resume and said, I really would like you to serve on our budget review task force as well. And she is eminently well qualified for this position, not because she's a trans woman, but because she has great business and financial experience. We know the more people know about what we're doing in Brighton, we will find more of those people and help them work for the people of Brighton.
Dr. Covington Jr., do you want to tell me about how you see the work of DEI at the community college level, how that impacts what FLCC does?
1,000,000,000%. So the first thing I would say in regards to diversity, equity, inclusion here at Finger Lakes Community College, we address diversity, equity, inclusion in a variety of ways, including addressing our campus climate, programming, enrollment, talent acquisition, curriculum, policy development, as well as town-gown relations. Three examples that I will provide you in regards to the impact of DEI, specifically here at FLCC, is relevant to our enrollment. So in 2018, we had about 17% of our students who are coming from underrepresented minority backgrounds, and we've been able to increase that to 26% in 2024. That's communicating to us that, one, that we're taking this charge very seriously, and we're continuing to attract students who are coming from diverse backgrounds. In addition to that, if we take into consideration the retention of these students, another opportunity to explore student success, we are also fully aware, most people probably know FLCC from our Canandaigua campus, but we also have three different campus centers in Victor, Newark, as well as Geneva. And at our Victor campus center, we see that we've been able to double the number of our female students who are pursuing STEM programs, right? So historically, STEM has been saturated by specifically white males, but we're now able to have more female students. Once again, we doubled the number of female students who are going into our STEM programs. Another example that I would happily share is that our ability to retain our students who are living with a disability tends to be higher in certain years than our regular student population. So we are seeing a variety of, for lack of a better word, dividends being paid to the institution. The research is showing that the American demographic is continuing to become more diverse, and Finger Lakes Community College is continuing to support this change by keeping our doors open as an open access institution. Quite frankly, as the American demographic continues to change, support of diversity, equity, inclusion becomes a matter of organizational sustainability in addition to being the right thing to do.
Sim, do you get the sense that people in academia are looking at what the White House is doing and are concerned that, part and parcel of what the executive order carried last week is the threat or the idea that any federal funding could be cut if you maintain DEI programs or offices? Is that conversation happening? Is there concern about that?
I would say across the board of higher education, that conversation is definitely happening. But I would tell people to take a pause. So the epitome of higher education is clearly encouraging people to engage in critical thinking. So that includes challenging assumptions, taking the time to be strategic around problem solving, looking at evidence-based decision-making, right? Anything can come from any elected official, including myself, but you want to take the time to pause. So what we're doing specifically here at FLCC, one of the pros that we have of being within a state university system is that that system continues to provide us with guidance. So we're waiting for additional guidance from the SUNY system as well as from New York State. So as these changes are happening, Evan, in real time, we're keeping our finger on the pulse. When Trump dropped something on Tuesday, I was literally in Albany at SUNY Central on Wednesday, right? We're continuing to have conversations either coming through my office as the chief diversity officer. We're having things coming to the college president's office as well as the college provost. As a college cabinet, we're continuing to have conversations and keeping our board of trustees informed because we want to make sure that we have a campus that's one responsive to the changes that are taking place. And we're being responsible in regards to the climate that we have here for our students, faculty, and staff.
I think part of what you're hearing from Dr. Covington Jr. is just someone who works in DEI making the case, saying, all right, I mean, here's how we see the case for this. And that's probably what's going to happen now, is that if DEI is going to stay, it's going to have to make the case because you have a White House that wants it gone. And in a sense, that may be healthy. I mean, it's just a question of whether people feel like there's good faith going on. Listeners, I know you want to weigh in. I've got some emails I promise I'll get to coming up. I see Dorothy in Rochester. I'll take your call coming up here. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you call from Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. If you're watching on our WXXI News YouTube channel, I never know what camera to look at. Is there a camera right there? There's something right there. Hello. It's been a year since I've been on television. My hair's thin too much. But you can join the chat section on YouTube. The YouTube chat is a great place to jump in as well. So a lot of places to interact. We'll get to some of your feedback in just a moment. I do want to hit one other point with all of our guests, though. And I'll start with Sim, and I'll go back across the panel here. When it comes to why this assault is happening, you know, when new programs and initiatives roll out and then they crumble, one of two things is happening. Either they really didn't, there were some own goals, they didn't work very well, there were some self-inflicted wounds, or there's, you know, really strong cultural and ideological difference that seeks to exploit politics, which I'm not going to shock anybody, it's a very political moment. But Sim, are there some own goals, some missteps that DEI has made as you see it, or do you view this as purely an ideological attack from the White House? Are you there,
question.
Sim? Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sim. Go ahead, Sim.
First, what I was going to say is I want to be brutally honest. And first and foremost, I think that's a great question. And here's my response. When it comes to this work, Evan, it's not necessarily what you do, it's how you do it. And what I mean by that is when it comes to supporting DEI, specifically when it comes to the presidential election, I think that some of the angst that has impacted the American landscape is when things operate as what people may conceptualize themselves as an extreme, right? So when people think that something is taking place at an extreme, eventually that's going to contribute to a certain level of resistance. One of the things that with the support of the college president here at FLCC that I've been able to do effectively here in Ontario County is to work with a variety of stakeholders on and off campus in regards to bridging these conversations. And we've made considerable progress. Examples of that would be my engagement with different school districts around doing this work. And when we're having these conversations, once again, the way you do it, it typically doesn't lead to angst. And I also need to reiterate that the invitation to come back tends to be repeated because your approach to the work, I think, is going to be very important. Something else that I've been able to do effectively, specifically here in Ontario County, is that I do implicit bias training for every law enforcement agency in Ontario County. And I'm saying that to you as a 6'5", dark-skinned African-American male, right? And these law enforcement agencies are continuing to invite me back. So when it comes to your question about whether or not there's an agenda, to give you a direct answer, yes, I think there is an agenda. And part of that agenda is to promote this whole concept of a meritocracy that's taking place in the United States, which many would conceptualize as a forced meritocracy. The real history of this country includes racism, sexism, ableism, colonization, et cetera. So diversity, equity, inclusion is taking intentional and strategic steps to make sure that individuals who are coming from diverse backgrounds are given an equitable opportunity.
Supervisor Maley, what do you think this is all about?
Well, I do live in a political world, of course. It's a governmental world, but the politics are always there. And, you know, what we've seen is this new administration is just throwing a whole bunch of stuff up against the wall. Apropos to what you had your guests the last hour, the town of Brighton has signed on to a brief in support of a preliminary injunction against the birthright citizenship issue that, you know, totally out of left field. Birthright citizenship is enshrined in the Constitution. And I'm very confident that will get reversed. So I think we're seeing lots of stuff thrown at the wall to see what's going to stick, not, without apparently too much regard for the underlying legal basis in it. But I also think it's without regard to the impact that these things are going to have. We're seeing it across communities. You know, DEI, the diversity of a town like Brighton, is much more than race. It's faith. It's the fact that a community like Brighton is very welcoming to the LGBTQ community. We've had people in the last several weeks coming into our clerk's office to get marriage license because they're afraid, and we've seen it. We've seen Republican elected officials trying to call on the Supreme Court to reverse the Obergefell decision. Marriage equality is the law of the land. So much of what is being targeted here is the law of the land, and it's important to who we are as a small community in Brighton, but as a nation.
Well, let me play a devil's advocate, though. You are someone, and you've been in Brighton in government for a while. You profess a desire to have a fair and truly successfully diverse and merit-based set of hiring practices. So if you got rid of the, you know, diversity department, or you didn't have a chief diversity officer, you know, I think some people would say, well, it saved taxpayers a few dollars. I mean, you're not gonna hurt anybody. I mean, you're a good guy. You're gonna have good hiring practices. What changes if you don't have a DEI officer?
Well, I don't profess to bring all the different skill sets to the position that the rest of our team brings, whether it's a chief diversity officer, or, you know, whether it's people in the other areas, our parks director. Sure, we could probably do without a parks director, but then who's going to give us the guidance, the leadership that we need to do our jobs that serve the people of our community? So I don't think it costs the residents of Brighton money. I think it would cost the residents of Brighton not only money, but quality of life. If we were to just unilaterally eliminate the work that we're doing, we have, I keep going back to this, but it's true. The diversity in a town like Brighton, you know, mobility and accessibility, we're doing a major renovation project in Town Hall now. For years, if you walked into Town Hall and were a person with a mobility disability in a wheelchair, for example. You had to come in the back door and go up an elevator. Back door sounds an awful lot like back of the bus to me, and that's not acceptable. As part of this project, we're going to be putting in ramps so that people can come in the front door in their wheelchair or with whatever other mobility assistance they need, and that is DEI. So when people, as seems to be too often the case, are focused on race and maybe immigration status, and those are important pieces of being supportive of a diverse community, but it is much more than that.
Chad Anderson, Vice President of BloomRock, what do you think this is all about right now?
Yeah, Evan, you mind repeating the question for me?
So when you look at this, not just the White House, not just the president's attack on DEI, but some of the cultural backlash,
right,
some of the drop in support for DEI. Do you think it is because it's being sort of leveraged as a cultural issue without really kind of merit? Or are there reasons that has DEI made some missteps?
I also agree that's a great question. I do just kind of want to preface I'm answering this as Chad Anderson, not as Vice President of BloomRock.
Fair enough.
You know, just got to make sure that delineation's made. But I think, you know, as Brandy, who you met as well, says quite frequently, I think there's two things happening at the same time. I think on the one hand, it 100% is an agenda that they're pushing. I'm sure, you know, we don't need to really get into it today, but we all know what Project 2025 is and what the implications of that. And I feel like it's always been no secret once and if Trump were to get into office, what that would look like from especially a DEI standpoint, since we're just talking about that today. So I certainly do think that there's a targeted push to just continue to, you know, wedge a wider gap in what that looks like as far as the tensions in our, you know, in our nation goes. And that can be from race tensions, that can be man and woman, that can be, you know, this sex to that sex, that's whatever that necessarily looks like. So on the one side, I certainly do think it is a direct attack on social equity. Even kind of in my specific industry, the cannabis industry, you know, we saw our first attack probably, I would say about a year and a half to 2 years ago now. And kind of what that looked like for us specifically is, you know, I'm sure like we spoke about when we first came on the show, these numerous lawsuits. This isn't the first time somebody claimed the unconstitutionality of a piece of legislation, that legislation in our specific case being the MRTA, due to something about, you know, some sort of inclusion or something. So like I said, you know, just say all that to say it is a directed, targeted push. But on the other hand, nothing's perfect. I feel like I find myself talking about this, you know, frequently. Once again, to our specific industry, the cannabis industry, we're going on 4 years now. We've been around since the MRTA was signed in 2021. It'll actually be four in March of 2025, this upcoming year. And, you know, just like any C-level business, let's call it, you don't expect, you know, the next corporation to be successful within 3 to 5 years, correct? We can all agree those are their seed stages. So when you implement a brand new governmental agency, that being the Office of Cannabis Management, to implore them to, you know, regulate this industry, when we're talking about DEI, we're talking about sales, we're talking about all the things that the adult use cannabis industry encompasses, we want them to do that. You know, they make mistakes, which is okay. I think making mistakes is okay. What I can say, though, is as far as what success looks like, once again, in our specific industry, it was recommended 51% of the market always be allocated to socioeconomic equity licenses. As of today, the market is, I want to say, 54.1. I was just looking at it. Yeah, 54.1, with a focus on minority and women-owned businesses. So, like I said, I think there's two things going on at the same time. Yes, it is a direct attack on just culture, DEI, belief systems. But, you know, at the same time, I think it's fair to say that anything, especially private sectors, governmental sectors, can always use work. And to not say that, you know, to say DEI is perfect is just, you know, out of the realm. I feel like that's all I'd be kind of real here. But, you know, in a broad sense, that's kind of my feelings.
All right, fair enough.
Situation.
Jessica Lewis, what do you think this is all about?
So I think what we're seeing is obviously there's been a transfer of power. And whenever a political group has the ability to enact executive orders, they're going to do so in a way that serves their interest. And so we've been hearing this rhetoric around Make America Great Again, America being in its golden age. Well, my question is, for whom? So we know that Black Americans' history with this country has been one that has not really been that great, starting with the transatlantic slave trade, chattel slavery, Black codes, Jim Crow, things of that nature. And all too often when we have these conversations, we forget about the equity piece and what that really means. It means to give people what they need based on their circumstances so that they can then meet everybody else. And so when you have a group that has been historically disadvantaged competing with the group that has been advantaged, there's going to be inequity and inequality. And so what DEI has tried to do is level the playing field. But now you have an administration who is saying, you know what, we don't want this anymore. We want to go based on merit. Well, I just received an email about a local university celebrating its charter day, which started back in 1851. That was more than 100 years before Brown versus Board of Education. So that means that Black students and white students could not be educated in the same institution. So if your group has had a 100-year head start and mine has not, how could we possibly be entering the race at the same time with the same resources, etc.? There's obviously a level of unfairness, if you will. And so by rolling back these efforts, you continue to disadvantage marginalized groups.
Okay, so that's the landscape as our guests see them. We're talking about DEI. And what I have to do is this. If you're on the phone, if you've sent emails, we're going to get to them right after this only break. We're going to come back and we're going to work through, I think, comments on a lot of different angles here, which is, I think, fair as we talk about DEI. If you're just joining us, President Trump says no more DEI at the federal government at all. He wants his team to find ways to dismantle DEI everywhere. That's in the corporate sector. That's in academia. Target and Walmart have already, as Jessica mentioned, responded by kind of folding their tent and saying, okay, we're not going to do, you know, what we were doing with DEI anymore, and kind of trying to curry favor with the new administration. So we'll see where this goes. But we'll get to your feedback in just a second after this break. We've got Jessica Lewis, President and CEO of Lalu Public Relations, with us. Chad Anderson is Vice President of Bloom Rock, which is working in the legal cannabis space. Bill Maley is supervisor of the town of Brighton, which hired its own diversity officer, chief diversity officer, several years ago and talked about it on this program. And Dr. Sim Covington Jr. is with us on the line, the chief diversity officer for FLCC. We're right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we bring back a couple of recent conversations. Miguel Velazquez, the CEO of RTS, talks to us about the future of public transportation in the Rochester region. Then in our second hour, who are the artists of a generation? Who's the Bob Dylan of today? Does that exist anymore? Or has music been so fragmented that that doesn't exist? We'll talk about it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to hit something that a number of listeners have been asking about this hour that is, I think, related, but it's going to be its own conversation. And that's the question on funding for things like research and clinical trials and all kinds of things that are related to work that's happening in our community. There's still a lack of clarity there. NBC News was just reporting on this, and I'm just trying to sort through this that our production team has been sending me. I appreciate that. But the bottom line is, I don't have a full picture of that for you. I can't tell you that what's happening at U of R, URMC, or other research institutions elsewhere is going to be affected by this. It could, and I'm sure everyone's looking at it, but we'll do that on a different day. So I do appreciate those questions, but give us some time. We'll try to figure out more about that before we dig in there. All right, Dorothy in Rochester first. Hey, Dorothy, go ahead.
Hi, I am for DEI. I was raised in New York City, and we were a poor family living in Queens, but we had some disadvantages due to that. But we managed to survive it, but I was about 10 years old when they started busing kids into our neighborhood, and I thought that was fantastic because I met new people. And but I look back on the racial variety of people in that old neighborhood, and now it's still under 1% African-American in that neighborhood. But I just think that we have this president who's in office who's out to screw everybody over, and anybody who objects to him, he goes out of his way. Women, gays, anybody, just to migrants, he goes after them with this hatred that is ingrained in him, but I'm all for equality for everybody and special attention paid to the people who are on the low end of the totem pole, in my opinion.
Dorothy, I appreciate the phone call. You got some very strong opinions there. I appreciate that. I can tell you that some of the emails reflect Dorothy's point of view. In fact, I think Dorothy just cleared me from having to read several emails that say almost the same thing.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yep.
It's interesting because, you know, and I keep going back because the immigration issue is really tied in here. But you talked about students coming into the community and helping to revitalize things. Rochester as a community is not really growing organically. But one of the ways the community can and does grow is immigrants who come into this country and are building up our economic base. The work in the DEI area is not a zero-sum game. Years ago, I worked with people coming into the Rochester area from the Sudan, from the South Sudanese community, the Lost Boys. These were young men, mostly, who had literally walked across their country looking as refugees, and then had the opportunity to come to this country and others. They were bringing an energy, a vigor, and we are a stronger community when we welcome people who bring new perspectives, new energy, new skills to our community. And I look at what we're doing from a DEI perspective as exactly the same thing. We are finding opportunities to broaden our skill sets and reflect the breadth and depth of our community more effectively.
All right. I don't want to give Bill Maley a filibuster, but I'm going to start with you on this one. I want all of our guests to weigh in because I want to read three emails that offer a range of where I think the critiques are in terms of an ideological spectrum, starting with more on the political or cultural right. Joe writes to say, if a government directs funding to minority and women-owned businesses, how is that not discriminating against white people? Bill Maley, you're a town supervisor. You've been a town attorney. So Joe is saying, you know, because Jessica was talking to us about a history of inequity in this country that is undeniable. And so now we have a lot of emphasis on minority and women-owned businesses. But Joe's saying, isn't that de facto discrimination against white people? What do you say?
Well, in local government, that simply isn't what we do. We are not directing funds to women or to a particular minority-owned businesses or otherwise. But again, let's talk about Brighton. Let's talk about the kinds of the variety of restaurants, new Korean restaurant, new Puerto Rican restaurant, right across the street from Town Hall. There is a woman-owned business that is doing some great things in the travel industry. So rather than send money and resources, we are benefiting from the diversity, the fact that we have all these businesses that have chosen to come to Brighton, that are serving the Brighton community and making us a better place, I believe, to live and work.
Okay, Jessica?
Yes. Okay, so there's a level of ignorance that surrounds comments like that. And the reason why I say that is because there's an unawareness. If you read scholarly work by Nicole Hannah-Jones, Dr. Joy DeGruy, Ibrahim Kendi, you will begin to understand if the first ship landed here in 1619, where these individuals were bringing slaves, that there was an economic advantage that they already had. So you had an opportunity to come over here and settle because you were trying to get away from the queen and the magistrate. So you've had this advantage to amass wealth that has been passed down from generation to generation. So when we're talking about, and I can only speak from a racial perspective, I understand that the supervisor is broadening it, but for me, it's kind of like, that's why equity is important, to give people what they need based on their circumstance. And if you are ignorant to equity and what that means, then you'll submit comments like that because you don't understand.
You know, and if I could follow up real quickly, because race is obviously a very important part of that. Several years ago, the exhibit that they had at the museum showing, and I don't remember what it was called, but it was so striking to me to see an exhibit showing two piles of money from two Long Island communities one of which you had homeowners who had taken advantage of veterans-type programs and were able to build equity, and minority members, mostly Black community members, who did not have access to home ownership as a way to build personal financial stability, because programs, and we see it here, look at programs like CMIDA, the County of Monroe Industrial Development Agency. The reality is a lot of economic development funds and attention has gone not to these, you know, sort of perceived to minority groups, as that letter suggests. They've gone to large, successful businesses. Why did Target need economic development to build a big store next to Irondequoit Mall that helped hasten the decline of Irondequoit Mall? It hasn't been targeted to minorities all too often, and we certainly started to see it in this administration. Resources are being needlessly targeted at those who don't need it, at the most wealthy.
Okay. Joe, I appreciate that. Now, here's a set of comments from Colin. Colin has done work in the local labor federation, certainly on the left. Bill, maybe know who I do. This is Colin O'Malley. And I'm going to sum up some of the criticism, and then I'm going to read his exact words. But from the left, to the extent that I hear criticism of DEI, it sounds like this. Do you want to help groups that have been disadvantaged historically? Fix the economy. Have a much more truly equitable economy. The DEI is window dressing. Real economic reform is what's necessary. Here's what Colin says. As someone who believes intensely in the importance of racial and social justice, I think we should recognize DEI as the abject failure that it was always going to be. In a moment of important concrete demands, DEI gave major institutions a necessary PR escape. Has the racial wealth gap closed? Has segregation lessened? Is the disparity in prisons going down? Or is it like Costco, who got great PR for their DEI program while at the same time refusing to negotiate decent raises for their 18,000 largely people of color employees? And Colin finishes by saying, meanwhile, the far right has used these toothless PR programs as a reactionary rallying cry. Little has been gained. Lots has been lost. Seems like a staggering failure to me. I think everybody wants to jump on this. So go ahead, Jessica. We'll get everybody on this.
Okay. Can two things be true at once?
There we go.
You know what I'm saying? Right. Does he have a point? Absolutely. But what solution is he putting forward?
I think, and I want to speak for Colin, he's saying, just go. We've got to be relentless on the economy.
I would kind of this.
You're saying both and, but, mm-hmm. but go ahead.
Yeah, and I mean, I just would kind of just piggyback with what I'm assuming Jessica was going to say. But also, you know, kind of sympathizing with Colin to an extent. I think there's a multi-pronged approach to it. You know, like I said, Bloomrock, we are stationed situated solely in economic development and what that looks like. I'm always saying, you know, which I feel like, you know, this kind of maybe just goes back to when I was a kid and the participation awards, but I hate a participation award. And I think kind of to Colin's comment, he's to an extent insinuating that DEI, you know, is kind of the front for it. And I certainly do agree that economic development has to be done to kind of supplement that. What that looks like, I think that's where we start talking about some of the organizations, you know, obviously like Bloomrock, but, you know, not only Bloomrock in the cannabis industry, also outside of the cannabis industry, you know, Rock EDC, a lot of the organizations in that kind of helm that are doing the work to really, you know, boots on the ground. What does it look like to provide resources to actually, you know, I know some fantastic organizations and some fantastic private owned businesses that are where they are right now due to micro loans or micro grants from some of these, you know, municipal based organizations that help them get off the ground.
So Chad, when Colin says, show me the problems that have been solved because of DEI, you're saying, hey, in the legal cannabis space, we'll talk in 3 or 5 years and see if this has worked.
Absolutely, yeah.
But your intention is not to have a participation award. You want to see a material difference.
Exactly. I hate participation.
Okay, let me get Sim and Bill on this. Sim Covington Jr., Chief Diversity Officer for FLCC. Colin says, tell me a problem that DEI has actually improved or solved.
That is a great question. I've been playing the sideline here listening for a while, and there's so much I would want to say. So the first thing I would say in regards to Jessica mentioning the level of ignorance, I'll use my personal life as an example. I'm proud alumni of the University of Alabama. So the University of Alabama was founded in 1820. But the stand at the schoolhouse door was in 1963. So to Jessica's very valid point, for 143 years, regardless of my interests, proximity, or academic prowess, I legally in this country would not even be admitted to the University of Alabama per se, simply because of the color of my skin. So that reinforces the, for lack of a better word, advantage of four generations that she spoke about that is very valid to this point. In regards to progress that DEI has made, quite frankly, the question that was submitted by our colleague Colin reinforces the issue in the first place. Everything that he talks about perpetuates the whole concept of systemic racism. And this whole concept of, he talks about economic development, though important, I would still highlight the issues when it comes to systemic racism. So for example, if we're gonna talk about economic development, the first question I'm gonna have is who gets a seat at that table, right? That's gonna be very important. If we're talking about economic development, whose story are we telling? Who's missing from the conversation, and how are we going to move that forward? Now, in regards to some tangible progress that has been made with DEI, obviously a perfect example of that would be the civil rights movement, right? There has been progress in this country when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion, but that progress still has a long way to go. I provided some tangible examples of things that we're doing here at Finger Lakes Community College. But once again, in addition to FLCC, higher education, K-12, America and society still has a long way to go. If we think about things that have plagued this country since its founding, one of the things that was brought up was chattel slavery, Jim Crow laws. I also mentioned that. We still have a long way to go. There are some tangible things that have taken place in regards to the efforts around DEI. For example, minority and women-owned businesses, right? In regards to being intentional and strategic about allocating funds because you're recognizing the disenfranchised who have, quite frankly, built the fabric of this country by default of chattel slavery, et cetera, right? So though we understand his question, my question back to him, and Evan, once again, I'm not looking for you to answer it. A lot of times people can acknowledge the issue while simultaneously having the privilege to sit on a sideline of it. So typically when we're having individuals who are critics, my response is, no, I don't need your criticism. The fact that you acknowledge that the issue exists, I need your help. That would be my response to Colin.
Okay, Supervisor Maley.
And yes, Colin, I mean, I do, you know, Colin's been active in the labor movement among other progressive organizations in this community. But if you look at the labor movement, for example, I mean, it's always had, different facets to it. And politically at certain times, it has been a more conservative force than you might expect. Here in the Rochester community, I look at organizations like the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, Pride at Work, as having not only changed the nature of labor organizations in this community, but they have worked together to make those organizations, the organized labor movement in Rochester, more inclusive, more effective. And, you don't have to hang a DEI sign on the door. These are all part of effective movements that move the needle. I don't want to let the perfect stand in the way of the good. Colin is absolutely right at the end of that statement when he talks about, programs like this. We're seeing it today. They are a red herring, and people are targeting. But what they're targeting has, in many cases, yes, successfully moved the needle and brought job opportunities, housing opportunities. We, in Brighton, it's little things. It can be incremental. Before the state, I was surprised the state didn't have this law that you couldn't discriminate against Section 8 recipients in terms of housing. And we passed a law in Brighton to make that illegal. We got some pushback, but those incremental movements make a broad swath of the community better off.
I'm going to be out of time, so 20 seconds. Can the federal government say to towns like yours, hey, you have a DEI officer, no more funding for you until you scrap that department?
We are not going to roll over. I don't believe they can, and we are going to continue because our work has been successful in Brighton.
Do you think you'll have to go to court over it?
I hope not. But I've been past president of the New York State Association of Towns. I am very confident, just as that this litigation against the birthright citizenship, I am very confident that we have the right to do what we're doing because it works.
Chad Anderson at BloomRock has said that, hey, let's talk in 3 to 5 years. Let's see if organizations like Bloom have been successful in the DEI sphere, in the legal cannabis space. You got a big event coming up on Saturday.
Absolutely.
Tell people about it. What's going on?
Absolutely. So we're doing our second annual award ceremony and gala this Saturday at Glen DeVere's on Old Browncroft Road in Penfield. This is just a really big event for us as far as fundraising goes. Awards, we have 9 awards. We're going to be recognizing community members for their efforts in the industry and really just a way to destigmatize cannabis. That's really also rooted in our mission at Bloom Rock. You know, when we have cannabis tax revenues coming back to municipalities, we want to be able to, you know, help out. I was just talking to
supervisor.
Absolutely, on, you know, what's Brighton's plan for it? You know, what's that look like? That's going to be a 1% of $1 trillion is a lot of money. So, you know, just talking through that. But yes, if you're interested in coming to the event, please go to Eventbrite, search Bloom Rock, or you can find us on Bloom on Instagram at Bloom_Rock.
Hey, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Jessica, as we say goodbye to you, 20 seconds, how would you advise Target and Walmart based on what you've seen them do in the last week?
Bring back DEI and support small black-owned businesses.
You tell them straight up.
Yes, like Lalu.
There we go.
Jessica's president, CEO of Lalu Public Relations, thank you for being here. Bill Maley, thank you, from the town of Brighton. Thank you for being here. And Sim Covington Jr., Dr. Covington Jr., the whole question on the academic world is probably its own conversation. Thank you for bringing us into that sphere, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Thank you much.
Chief Diversity Officer for FLCC. From all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Media.